Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is humankind's relationship to the sun? Our earliest ancestors must have watched with wonder as this source of light and heat swept predictably across the sky each day. As they came to understand the sun's vital role in their survival, many cultures deemed it worthy of veneration. Some pictured a sky-dwelling creator or prayed to sun gods directly. They depicted saints with halos that glowed like tiny suns. The tradition of trying to understand exactly what the sun is and how it works is also an ancient one. People recorded its positions in our sky, tied it to the measurement of time, and tried to understand it in comparison to other celestial bodies. In many ways, the era of modern science has demystified the sun. We understand its physical properties and its effects on everything from the tides to the climate to our skin. But it is no less vital to our existence and never will be. Richard Cohen is former publishing director of Hutchinson and of Hodder and Stoughton. His new book is called Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. Richard, welcome to Think.
Good afternoon, Chris. Nice to be with you.
I want to talk about how this book came about. You essentially set out to write the book about the sun that you wished you could read.
I was brought up, despite my surname, I had an Irish Catholic mother, so I was sent away to be educated by Benedictine monks, and they didn't really care much about science. Maybe that's a bit unfair, but if you were an arts graduate or type as I was, they didn't push it on you. So I left high school, really pretty ignorant about the sciences, and always felt a bit guilty about that. And knowing the sun was so important to our lives, I thought I really would like to commission a book. I wanted to read a book that told me about the sun in its scientific form, but also how it had informed and inspired the arts, really everything about the sun. And I approached one or two people who felt it was really too large a subject, rather sensibly. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to read this book, I'm going to have to write it myself. And that's how it happened.
You know, there are not many books that endeavor to combine physical science and anthropology and religion and art. Were you surprised at how well it does, in fact, work to put all those things together?
I was constantly surprised. I mean, I set off, people said, well, what's the theme of your book? And I felt, well, I really was just informed by curiosity. But by the end of the time it took to research and to write it, I mean, it took 8 years overall, I'd had a wonderful time. I mean, literally wonderful, in the sense that I discovered the sun got into everything and did so in the most interesting, fascinating ways.
About 7 years ago, you went to witness a total eclipse of the sun. Can you talk about that experience?
Yes, I felt that really solar eclipses, I mean, obviously there are lunar eclipses and there are partial solar eclipses, but complete solar eclipses are one of the most extraordinary things in nature, and I ought to see one for myself. And the next one was going to be in Antarctica, which was seemingly an ungettable to place. But I applied to a New York Science Foundation, the Sloan Foundation, and they gave me a grant to do a lot of this traveling. And so I flew down to Cape Town and found myself in a room with about 60 other people, most of them kind of eclipse chasers. They would go to all over the world just to see the latest eclipse. But we were told that there'd been huge storms on the bit of Antarctica that was willing to receive us, a Russian Antarctic station, and only one tent was left standing. People had been isolated in it for 48 hours, and there was a second storm, even worse, coming up behind it. And we might not be able to get there at all, it was if we couldn't. And we were due to fly in a decommissioned Ilyushin 76 Russian jet, and the pilot, who was an old hand and a chain smoker, kind of looked up and said, as he stubbed out another cigarette, "I think we can do it." And so we all piled into this old plane, and we did do it. We flew in between the two storms and witnessed this amazing, amazing sight of the sun being blotted out by the moon.
Even now, and I guess it was 2003, when we know how this happens and why it happens, is there something about that experience that is a little bit sort of frightening at the core of your being?
For millennia, it did strike fear into people's hearts. And even now, if you go to, well, certainly places in India, there are a number of myths which still hold people fast. It's still believed that if a pregnant woman goes out during an eclipse, the baby she'll be carrying will be born either blind or with a cleft palate. And women smear their bellies with a mixture of ghee and as clarified butter and cow dung, which are meant to preserve them from any of the evils that an eclipse may bring about. And people do have these old fears which won't go away. And when you do see the sky blotted out, suddenly darkened, I mean, when I was in Antarctica, it was us, and then just ice as far as you can see, with this blue translucent glow around the edges of the horizon. It was rather wonderful.
Talk about the fact that the sun really ties into creation mythologies all over the world, to the extent that it's almost a universal element in those. Can you speak about that a little bit?
There was a person in the 19th century who is utterly forgotten now. He sounds like a music hall comedian or someone you find on late night comedy shows, called Max Müller. And he was a German who was a Sanskrit scholar, and he came over to Britain in the mid-19th century to continue his studies. And he ended up professor at Oxford in three different subjects, religion, language, I forget the third, but he was an extraordinary person who in his day was as well known as Charles Darwin. And he said that Sanskrit was the original language and carried with it a whole range of solar words, myths, which the rest of the world had taken up. And indeed, that the metaphors we have, whether we say good morning, good day, or whatever, come from the fact that as man looked up and saw this great orb in the sky, our very idea of circles and the rest, you know, the sun helped us invent the wheel, he argued, all of these were as fundamental as any other part of the way that human beings got to organize themselves and their language. And he overstretched, but a lot of what he says still makes sense today. I think if he had said it applies to a lot of language and a lot of cultures, he'd have got away with it, and maybe we'd still remember him.
You know, what's really interesting, Richard, is things that we take for granted, like the idea that many cultures have that God or gods dwell in the heavens. That's not something that is automatic, necessarily.
Not at all. The sun is obviously so powerful, and yet ancient man said, well, if the sun is going its way from east to west every day and every day and every day, how can it be the ultimate power? Because it never gets a day off. And there was a continuing need, I think, in most cultures to feel that although the sun was powerful, man could still control the sun in some ways. When Carl Jung went to speak to the Indians in New Mexico in the 1920s, he was talking to an elder there who said, we have to look at the sun and look after it, because if we don't look at it every day, it may not turn up the next day. So there's this feeling that we had some control over the sun as a way of balancing out the fact that we knew that its power over us was so great.
What can we tell about early cultures' attention to the sun based on the artifacts and the monuments that they've left behind?
There are over 3,000 monuments stretching around the world, monuments to the sun. And they aren't just there as ways of worshipping the sun. I mean, one knows that the pyramids, in not just in Egypt, but in South America and Central America, Stonehenge, they really are dotted around the world. Many of them were also observatories, so that almost before there was, or certainly before there was any what we would call organized science, people were trying to show that they could work out when the solstices might fall, when the seasons were going to change, and so on, by when the sun went through particular buildings at a particular time. There's a wonderful old burial site in Newgrange in Ireland that at the coming of the winter solstice in Ireland, the sun will come and travel 19 meters from the start of the burial mound through to a little cup at the end of this pathway and fill the cup with golden light. And it only does so on that one day of the year for about 17 minutes at the winter solstice.
What's amazing about stories like that, and there are similar monuments in other parts of the world, is the years it must have taken to figure out exactly where to site that thing.
It's true. And of course, one of the things is that because the Earth wobbles, because it moves on its axis, nothing stays still, even in the world of astronomy and cosmology. So that some of the ancient structures I'm thinking of in Delhi, in Jaipur, 19th century Maharajas made extraordinary outdoor monuments, sundials and other great monuments that measured things about the sun. Well, as we've moved, these monuments have become slightly inaccurate. And I went to, for instance, the great range of, I think there were 12 large measuring devices in Jaipur, in northwest India, and I spoke to the main astronomer there, who said, "See, this particular structure will tell you when the solstice falls." And I said, "But it's 2 days out of kilter. It's saying that it's going to fall on the 21st of September. This is the equinox, and it's fallen on the 23rd." And this is because, basically, the world has moved on, literally.
Talk about how, over time, we've ascribed gender to the sun.
Most societies feel the sun is male. And again, it's a way of anthropomorphizing things in the heavens so that they are easier for us to deal with and to understand. But there are some societies, in Germany, for instance, and in Celtic lands, where the sun is female and it's the moon which is male. And a number of cultures also have the sun and moon as husband and wife. And there's some wonderful stories about how they get on or how they fail to get on.
Yeah, there's one, and the sun is a male, and his wife essentially is just worn out by him.
That's right. It's a Bengali myth where the sun has his three eyes and four arms and blazes away. And the wife says, "I can't stand this anymore." And, as the moon, the wife moves away until the sun, as a wonderful step in marital compromise, tones himself down, does not become so blazing, and the moon says, "Okay, the marriage can go on then." And that was the Bengali myth that people felt was true.
How did pagan sun rituals play into Christian traditions that followed later?
The seasons, as the seasons changed, were marked in pagan cultures in all kinds of ways. Fertility rituals, great bonfires, general commemorations. And when Christianity came in and was made a state religion by Constantine in the 4th century AD, these pagan rituals, really honoring the sun, were perfect for being stolen, almost kidnapped, by the new religion. So nobody really knows when Christ was exactly meant to be born. But in the 4th century, the Christian religion said, it's the 25th of December. And it scooped up all the solar celebrations, which were commemorated on the 25th, and made that the day of the Nativity. And it served them very well. Of course, they then had the trouble for the next few centuries of saying, "Stop worshipping the sun. You're meant to be worshipping the Son of God." And there was quite a battle to make people stop their old pagan celebrations.
Richard Cohen is my guest. We're talking this hour about his new book, Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. We'll be back to our conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Cohen. He is former publishing director of Hutchison and of Hodder & Stoughton. His new book is called Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Richard, how was the sun used as a symbol of power by earthly leaders?
It's been so obviously a piece of the heavens which exerts massive power that politicians really, from the beginning of humankind, have said, how can we bask in its reflected glory? So that from the earliest time, rulers would say, we don't want our people looking at us in the face. They should treat us with a great reverence so that they would appear sun-like. But I have one chapter in my book, which I originally didn't plan to have in at all, and then it became one of the most interesting chapters, where I tracked in the last 130 years or so how so many powerful rulers have used the sun in very specific ways. The Nazis, for instance, not only took over the old sign of the sun, the swastika symbol, from Asian societies and made it the symbol of National Socialism, but they took a lot of old sun beliefs to underpin National Socialism's kind of academic worthiness. And they took some of Jung's views, and I was mentioning Max Müller earlier in the program. They used these absolute non-racists to underpin their ideologies. In Japan, you've got the emperors of Japan, up until Hirohito, saying that they were themselves divine, that they were direct descendants of the sun goddess, Amaterasu. And it was only after the war when General MacArthur said to Hirohito, you must declare to your people that you're not divine, that that particular belief was broken. And then you get Chairman Mao, who even before he took absolute power, was using the sun as really the main image for his beliefs in the Cultural Revolution and so on. And if you look at the little red book, on its cover you get Mao in a sun-like sphere with great golden rays of the sun all emanating from him.
That sounds remarkably like early depictions of Christian saints with halos and rays of sun emitting from their bodies.
Well, there's no harm in a good idea, however old it may be. And, I mean, recently, before he was made Pope, and the present Pope Benedict, when he was really kind of number two in the Vatican hierarchy, he published a book in 2002 about Christian Catholic liturgy. And he, in that book, just says the Son of God is the Son, and the Son is Jesus, in amazing language. And at one point he said, well, we don't have to worry about all the kind of stories about whether the Catholic Church appropriated pagan myths for Christmas. I mean, that's really in the past. And he goes on as if he was kind of PR for the sun in a remarkable way. But, of course, it's a very specialized book. People don't know that he said these extraordinary things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. First on the line, we have Mohammed in Tyler. Hi, Mohammed.
Hey, how are you there?
Very well, thanks.
Yes, I have a question for your guest there today. It's a very interesting conversation. I have a question regarding the sun. He said that at one time people were worshiping the sun as God, and I want to know that did they get that from the mythological language for the saying sun god, and was it transposed over from the spelling of S-U-N sun to S-O-N sun, reflecting Jesus as the Son of God?
Well, that relates,
the religious language comes from mythological language in ancient Egypt and whatever.
Thanks for your call. It relates back to what we were just talking about, Richard.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for the question. Of course, sun, S-O-N, is only the Son of God in the English language. In many other countries, you don't get the sun connection at all. So that's just a happy accident for English-speaking Christians. But as I said, the pagan beliefs about the sun were so powerful, they were just a gift, come Christianity, to take this faraway great power, the source of heat, the source of light, the source of indeed all life, and to just abrogate it to their own belief system. But that's true of you know, the first Christians, you do get sufficient variety through the world that the sun isn't always seen as a source of good or even as the main power over us. In Africa, for instance, the earth and rain are worshipped more than the sun. I mean, the sun's power is acknowledged, but it's seen as destructive, pestilential, sometimes almost evil. In China, although the sun, as I say, under Mao, was seen as a great force, it wasn't seen as the only, or certainly not the principal even, power in the heavens. They had a very different view of the world. So as you go around the world, the sun is always acknowledged and often worshipped as a great power, but the degree of that power alters depending on the particular culture involved.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Don in Bedford. Hi, Don.
Hi. There is a kind of a viral email circulating right now that is purporting to prove the infallibility of the Bible by citing some kind of a scientific projection that scientists are making about the position of the sun and the stars and the planets in the future, and it says that they have in some way found a missing day in all of their calculations, and this email is saying that this proves the purported fact that in one story in the Bible that the sun stood still for a day and didn't move. Now, discounting what that would actually do to the earth to have it stand still for a day, the story seems to try to prove the infallibility of the Bible this way, and I just wonder if there's anything to this story.
Don,
about the calculations.
Thank you for your question. I wouldn't worry. One of the things about the sun is, because of its great power, it gets a range of dotty enthusiasts behind it. And whether it's Zoroastrianism, whether it's alchemy, whether it's Freemasonry, or indeed people who believe through the Mayan sun prophecies that Armageddon is going to strike us in 2012, I'm afraid that I am a total disbeliever in all these things. And I think your viral email goes on that list. It's fascinating that culturally so many people should spend time thinking through what I regard as dotty theories, although built often on a lot of work, working them out. But I don't think there's much truth to be placed on them.
It's fascinating, Richard, that even after humans learned to anticipate, they understood the seasons of the year, they could predict eclipses, and yet they still found them to be very disquieting. Will you talk about the Babylonians?
Well, the Babylonians, although there were people who did various researches and thinkings about the sun, when eclipses might occur, and so on, the Babylonians were the first people who really kept organized records about the sun, and they could predict pretty well when an eclipse was going to fall. And the Babylonians' gift to mathematics, they had some superb mathematicians, and they were taken over by the Greeks initially. But they really laid the foundations for a lot of mathematics. And one of the things they could do, for instance, was just to show how science and myth would go hand in hand. When an eclipse is about to occur, their reckoning, they would take the king down from his throne regarding an eclipse still as having many evil things connected to it. Mm-hmm. And they would go into their dungeons and take some poor benighted prisoner and put him on the king's throne as if they were going to outwit the sun. And the sun would feel that the prisoner was the king, and if he was going to do anything bad in his eclipse, that it would fall this person on the throne. And meanwhile, the real king would continue the business of government, but all his ministers would call him Farmer, dear farmer, do you think we should do this? Should we do that? And once the eclipse had happened, it had passed, and the sun was back visible in the sky, the king would go back on his throne, and the poor prisoner would be put to death. And all he had going for him is he would be given a royal funeral.
It's very interesting. Before we had science, the ways that people tried to understand the sun, and obviously astronomy was sort of plugging along quite well even before modern science. But I want to talk about the Egyptian strategy for determining the size of the sun.
Well, the ancient, I mean, if one says anything before, I know, 400 AD, say, 500 AD, the ancient views on the size of the sun were, we might laugh at them now, but from their point of view, they were doing the best they could. And maybe in future centuries, people will laugh at us and some of our beliefs. But they would time how far a horse could go within a particular distance and work out from that the time it took for the sun to rise at dawn. And through mathematics, which I won't try and test your listeners with now, they reckon that they could work out its size from that exercise.
And it took a long time before anyone understood that the sun was not only large, but vastly larger than the Earth.
Well, the ancient Greeks, who we think of as extraordinary scientists, many of them had beliefs that the sun was the size of a shield, that the sun was a kind of big mirror that got it, and we got our light and our heat reflected off the sun, but there was some other power far vaster than the sun that was the original supplier of the heat and the light. There were extraordinary range of beliefs going through the centuries. And, of course, the one that's lasted longer was Ptolemy's belief that not only did the sun go around the earth, but the heavens were filled with 55 crystal spheres. And it was most elaborate, and we would think, strange belief for a first-class brain to come to. But this was what was generally held from Ptolemy's time, up until the kind of 2nd century AD, through to the time of Copernicus, even beyond, because a lot of people, of course, didn't hold with Copernicus' view that it was the other way around and that we were going around the sun.
I'm curious as to why Copernicus was not persecuted by the Catholic Church to the same extent that Galileo would be a century later.
Well, Copernicus was this shy, retiring Polish canon, and he held on to his beliefs for a long time. In fact, the book in which he said the earth goes round the sun, De Revolutionibus, was published so late in his life that he's on his deathbed before he got a finished copy. And even then, he was very cautious. He didn't really change the Ptolemaic system, apart from this central and, of course, colossally important view that it was the earth going round the sun and not the other way round. Galileo, who was this red-headed, fiery Paduan, was the person who took Copernicus's views, and despite warnings from the Vatican, in fact, Pope Urban IV was a great friend of his and a fellow astronomer, Galileo knew what he knew. He was sure Copernicus was right. And he wrote a satire, first of all in very ornate classical Italian, then in vernacular Italian, so lots of people could read it and understand it, making fun of what was in fact the church view. And that was enough to get him into hot water.
He also, Galileo, discovered sunspots.
That in its way, I know that, you know, the sun going round the earth being found to be an absolute untruth seems to us the great discovery. But sunspots in its way is a more remarkable story. In 1610, Galileo was told that this new invention, which was selling all over the streets of Paris, the telescope as we know it, could enable him to look up into the skies and see for the first time the sun, the moon in some detail. And he improved on the telescope that he got from Paris and looked up onto the sun and saw this great all-powerful orb had spots on it. And this was such an extraordinary feeling that something which was meant to be perfect in the way of thinking then should have this kind of facial acne that he kept his discoveries secret for 2 years, as against him beating the drum on Copernican discoveries. Sunspots were somehow a belittling fact, and many people felt when they learned of this that he was sure that they were sure this was wrong. There was something outside the sun that was just crossing the sun's surface. But I went to the Pope's observatory. He's got an observatory about half an hour's train journey from the centre of Rome, Castel Gandolfo, it's called. And I actually looked at, saw Galileo's books, where he made these exquisite drawings of sunspot activity. And it must have been overwhelming, the experience, to feel that he discovered that the sun was imperfect.
And I have to assume that at the time, everyone thought the sun was a solid object. Did Galileo say what he thought the sunspots were?
He didn't really know what they are, which may sound odd, but we still don't know today. And one of the things I talk about in the book is obviously the current debate on global warming. And there's Al Gore saying the science is all settled. Well, I'm not a global warming denier, but one of the things I do believe is, talking as I did to solar physicists around the world, I discovered that they feel that we're on the cusp of a period of, really kind of golden period of discovery about the sun, which will include what causes sunspots, how do they move, what effect do they have on our climate. And with so much to be discovered about the sun, I mean, it's not just sunspots, it's solar flares, coronal mass ejections, great burstings out from the sun, sometimes, often, of stuff, plasma, larger than the Earth. You know, all of this is going to change how we understand how our weather works.
And that's in part, we're due for all this learning because we are due for an episode of really intense sunspot activity.
Yes. Within the next 2 years, we've been enjoying or enduring, depending on your point of view, a period of non-existent sunspot activity. And this, over the next 2 years, astronomers say, is due to change. And back in, I think it was 1978, when there were violent solar storms due to sunspot activity, This affected Earth hugely. The whole of Quebec, for instance, had its electricity grid just knocked out at the cost of $4 million, which, I mean, I suppose would be more like $5 or $6 million now. So we know that these sunspots really do affect life on Earth.
Richard Cohen is with us. His new book is called Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Cohen. He is former publishing director of Hutchinson and of Hodder and Stoughton. His new book is called Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Do we know, Richard, why sunspots seem to wreak such havoc on our technology?
Well, we don't know enough, but we know certainly that it's not just the power of sunlight, which of course can burn and destroy, but the various things which spew out from the sun, coronal mass ejections, which can be several times larger than the Earth, solar flares, something which until the last century wasn't even recognized, solar wind, and also solar magnetism. All these things are different, and they all have different effects on our climate. And when people started initially writing about what they thought sunspots, say, did on the Earth, there were all kinds of wonderful theories. First of all, it was felt that in years when there was maximum sunspot activity, crops would go down. There'd be bad crop years, bad harvests, and this would have a visible effect on the world economies. Sunspots were blamed or thanked, depending on your view, for good or bad wine vintages, on the number of rabbits that would be born in a year. Even on revolutions, somebody worked out that revolutions from the French Revolution to the American Revolution happened at the time of maximum sunspot activity, and there was a connection between the two.
So everyone behaves a little strange. Everyone and everything behaves a little strangely.
That's the general belief.
You know, a lot of people are familiar with the idea that the moon affects tide cycles, but the sun also has a big impact on this.
I thought so. I mean, one of the things which I explain to people, I say, what do you think causes tides? And people say, the moon. And I say, well, actually, 44% of the gravitational pull that causes tides is due to the sun. And when you get the sun and the moon pulling in the same direction, you get high tides. And on such occasions, we all get taller because the pull is such from sun and moon together. Now, not by a noticeable amount. It's 0.000 whatever of an atom. But the truth is there. We all get taller.
How is it that that Isaac Newton was able to work out the relative size and gravitational pull of the sun and the Earth?
Well, the great myth, I don't know whether it's a myth or not, it depends on how you take the sources, of Newton watching an apple fall from the tree outside his rooms in Trinity College, Cambridge. Four people attest that he actually did see the apple fall and make the connection. I'm not so sure myself, but it doesn't really matter. What he felt was that the pull of gravity, weight, existed not only on Earth, but outside the Earth. It existed throughout the universe. And he actually had that insight years before he ever wrote about it. And it took three other major scientists of the day, Hooker and Wren, being two of them, really to have a wager, and one of them went to Newton, who was formidably antisocial and acerbic, and said, you know, have you worked this out? And he said, oh, I worked it out years ago, and I just haven't bothered to publish it, but I suppose I better do that now. he was one of the least likable geniuses that the world has ever known, but also one of the most extraordinary.
I thought it was also amazing that more than 1,000 years ago, there were Hindu scholars who came pretty close to estimating the correct age of the sun. Were they lucky guessers, or were they using numbers that made sense and came to a decent conclusion?
I wish I was enough of a mathematician to give you a clear answer. I don't think it was lucky guessing. We've had through the 2,000 years plus of history extraordinary figures who we now know came to the realization of truths which only hundreds of years later were generally accepted. One talks about Copernicus saying that the Earth goes round the sun rather than the other way round. But there was an ancient Greek astronomer who lived outside the main cities whose writings show that he very clearly believed this himself. But at the time, he was ridiculed. And people said, well, if the Earth is whizzing around like this, why don't we all get thrown off? Why do the birds stay above us in the sky? And this is so plainly a stupid view. We won't even pay any attention to him. And so people didn't. But you do get these, you know, scientists, not that they were called that in ancient times, but people who studied the heavens, realizing truths that it took hundreds of years before we accepted it as something that was just part of everyday life.
To what extent did astrology play into what became astronomy?
It was really the way in which astronomy could continue to exist. And although through the years people would try to ban astrology as being quite plainly something which didn't work.
Richard, are you with us?
Yes, sorry.
That's okay.
That was just a sunspot just crossing me out for a second. You have people like the Emperor Nero banning all astrologers from Rome, but keeping a private astrologer who, if the astrologer told him that there was plotting amongst his enemies, he would go out and kill anyone he thought came under that category. So there was a great deal of hypocrisy, but it was the prevalence of astrologers and the popularity of people who by examining entrails or whatever peculiar activities they said led to their ability to predict the future, that allowed astronomers to continue in their researches. And some of the greatest astronomers, I mean, Galileo, for instance, would make money telling people's fortunes, acting as an astrologer. So it was really, although it's hocus-pocus, it was a means by which, very often, real astronomers managed to get by financially.
Did Galileo believe what he was telling people, or was this just a sort of nice cover for him?
Oh, I think he knew that he was just onto a good thing. I mean, Galileo was his own best PR man. Now, it may have led to his being holed up in front of the Vatican authorities in Rome. I mean, he was never tortured, which some writers used to say he was. But he was put under house arrest and lived out the rest of his life, really, in quiet scholarship. But he was quite a lad. I mean, even in his days under house arrest, he wrote two comedies, he wrote two plays, which might have been Broadway successes in another age.
At what point did we start to recognize that the sun was in fact a star and it wasn't so exceptional, it just happened to be the closest one?
It was really with the development of powerful telescopes. Mm-hmm. And in the 18th century, post-Newton, you had this extraordinary father and son team, or rather father, sister, and son team, of William and his sister Caroline Herschel. William Herschel was a musician in a band in Germany and then fled to England. And although he continued to teach music, his real love was gazing at the stars. And he was eventually the person who discovered a new planet, Uranus, and was given a pension by the king, George III, to as a way of thanking him for this enormous discovery. But it was part of a general range of looking at the heavens and realizing that the sun was maybe our nearest star, but it wasn't even a very impressive one. It wasn't that large, it wasn't that powerful, and that the universe was far, far larger than humankind at that time ever imagined. And when he discovered that the sun was part of the Milky Way, which was full of millions of more impressive stars, and the Milky Way was just one galaxy among an uncountable number of other galaxies, that suddenly the sun became smaller and we became smaller. It was a very humbling experience when you think that we were just kind of, you know, a dot speck in a speck of time.
Do you think we've lost respect for the sun?
I do in some ways. One of the things that, although I was earlier in the program talking about these extraordinary, to us, unbelievable myths still exist in the Asian subcontinent, it was when I went to India that I realized that Hindus, particularly, who worship the sun still, have a kind of reverence and maybe almost a sanity towards the sun, which we don't have, and it's our loss. It's not just that, you know, we say, well, we know that the sun will burn us and it can give us cancers, and we then ignore that. So we still have hundreds of thousands of deaths per year because of skin cancers caused by the sun. It's we know that the sun is a wonderful source of alternative energy, and we feel we're in a crisis in terms of energy supply and so on. But the sun, in 44 minutes, gives the Earth as much power, solar energy, as we use up in an entire year in our cravings for energy. And yet we use ourselves, in terms of solar energy, just over 2% of our energy needs are met by solar energy, which seems to me, it's a kind of irreverence. We've got this great power that we could use, and we don't.
Do you think we will continue to improve that technology, or is it?
It's changing all the time. Yeah. The cost of solar panels and so on, all these, the costs are going down the whole time. And the ingenuity of scientists and people using technology is extraordinary, so that the ways in which we use solar energy are increasing both in number and in power almost by the week.
it's remarkable to think about this, that we all understand on some level that we would cease to exist almost immediately, or immediately if the sun were to not be available to us. There's nothing else like that, though, that we can actually, we can predict the demise of the sun. We know approximately when it will happen. We know approximately how it will play itself out. That's a strange condition of modern life.
Well, Chris, you say the sun not being available to us makes it sound as if the doctor can't see you now. where the sun is concerned, it's such an enormous thought. This may be why nobody has written the book I'm tried to produce before. They've been too sensible to attempt it. But you know, the sun is due to burn itself out, or at least not burn itself out. Nuclear reactions within it will cause it to cease in 5.5 billion years' time. So your program may not be on the air then.
Maybe I'll have retired anyway, so it should be fine.
But one's got to think that that's such an enormous step into time that we can't really get our heads around it. But well, long before the sun crumbles into waste, planets around it will have been subsumed or burnt to a crisp as it expands into red dwarfhood. But that still means there's plenty of time for human beings not only to discover things but to evolve themselves. Who knows what we call human beings will be evolutionary successes in 1 million years' time, 100,000 years' time. You know, time just seems a lot of figures to us. But we are very likely to have both evolved as a species and to have discovered means of traveling through space, which seem the stuff of science fiction now. I mean, I have a chapter on science fiction in the book, and I'm showing that even now, the people who are at the kind of cutting edge of technology don't seem to be worried by the notion of the sun finally ending. We'll be in another galaxy, in who knows what the future holds, but it may very well hold a continuance of the human race.
Was there a question you weren't able to resolve for yourself even through 8 years of research on this book?
It's an interesting question. I felt that I wish I was surer on the whole question of global warming. Mm-hmm. In other words, the two sides of the argument are so rancorous that although I, in my own mind, I'm sure that what we call greenhouse gases are not a force for good, the models that we have for the world's climate are still at such an early stage of development, it sounds odd, but they are, that we really still don't know much about the way our climate has changed and is affected by the sun.
I'm afraid we're out of time, so we'll have to stop there. Richard Cohen's new book is Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. Richard, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it.
Thank you for having me on your program.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.